From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today we talk with Benedict Cumberbatch, star of the new film The Power of the Dog. He was voted Best Actor for his performance by the National Society of Film Critics. He's also in the new film Spider-Man No Way Home as Doctor Strange. Many Americans were introduced to him as the star of the BBC series Sherlock. Also, we hear from Brian Cox, star of the HBO series Succession. He plays the ruthless patriarch in a family that runs a conglomerate which includes a conservative cable news network. Cox has written a new memoir that begins with nearly dying in childbirth. The drama on and off stage and screen continues from there. And Maureen Corrigan reviews one of this year's most anticipated books, To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara. My guest Benedict Cumberbatch stars in the new film, The Power of the Dog. The film was named one of the 10 best films of 2021 by the American Film Institute, appeared on many critics' 10 best lists, and won this year's Golden Globe for Best Movie Drama. Cumberbatch was named Best Actor for his performance in the film by the National Society of Film Critics and by film critics' associations in New York, Boston, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, and the San Francisco Bay Area. You can also see Cumberbatch now in Spider-Man No Way Home as Doctor Strange, and he's just completing work on the new Doctor Strange movie. Cumberbatch was nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in the film The Imitation Game, based on the story of Alan Turing, the mathematical genius who was instrumental in breaking the German Enigma code in World War II. Cumberbatch has played other real people like Stephen Hawking and Julian Assange. He's famous for his role as a contemporary version of Sherlock Holmes in the British TV series Sherlock. The Power of the Dog was directed by Jane Campion, adapted from the novel of the same name, and is set in 1925 in Montana. Cumberbatch plays Phil, who, along with his brother, played by Jesse Plemons, owns a cattle ranch. Phil is hyper-masculine. He's skilled at cutting the testicles off cattle, herding cattle, and braiding leather ropes. He rarely bathes. He's also a bully. He even insults his brother and calls him fatso. When they're taking the herd to market, they stop at an inn where they have dinner. They're served by a young man, the son of the woman who owns the inn. He has a clean white linen towel over one arm, the way you might see in a fancy restaurant, not a little inn in a tiny town. His manner and the linen make him seem effeminate to Phil. While the young man is serving the table where Phil, his brother, and the cowhands are seated, Phil picks up a paper flower from the handmade bouquet serving as the table's centerpiece and starts examining it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wonder what little lady made these.
Actually, I did, sir. My mother was a florist, so I made them to look like the ones in our garden.
Oh, well, do pardon me. They're just as real as possible. Now, gentlemen, look, see, that's what you do with the cloth.
It's really just for wine drips.
Oh, you got that, boys. Only for the drip. Now get us some food.
Phil's brother apologizes to the waiter's mother and soon marries her. When she moves to the ranch, Phil torments her, and when her son visits, Phil continues to mock and bully him. As the film progresses, we begin to get clues about what lies beneath Phil's exterior. Benedict Cumberbatch, congratulations on your performance and on the film. And I should mention, as we record this on Wednesday, January 12th, this morning, you were nominated for a SAG Award, the Screen Actors Guild Award, which is fantastic because that's like a jury of your peers. Those are actors voting, and they know their stuff. So congratulations. That must be a real honor for you.
Thanks so much, Terry. It really is, and thank you. Thank you for having me. It is a fortuitous moment, and you're right. It's such a great validation of the work to have your peers who share this craft with you as their work to recognize it in this way. It's really, really humbling, a great honor.
So The Power of the Dog is a Western of sorts. I mean, it's set on a cattle ranch, and your character is he's a cowboy. So did growing up in England as you did American Westerns mean much to you? And did you study like the history of the American West or anything?
I mean, not really, no. It's about as far from my lived experience as you can imagine, which I guess is part of the enticement of wanting to take this character on and this milieu on. But no, I certainly didn't have a history of it. I had a little understanding of it from university, from studying cinema at that stage in my life. I guess the first inkling I had of a traditional Western, it was the more sort of John Ford, tough man, the John Wayne. But also for me, I think where I really clicked into it was probably High Noon. I thought, here's deliverance from an unassuming hero in a way. And then the revisionist era of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven began as well, which for me was at a very formative time in my cinema going experience. But it certainly wasn't a playground role play thing for me. And it wasn't something I grew up fantasizing about or knowing anything about.
Yeah. You said that Westerns, cowboys, didn't mean anything to you growing up because it was so far from your experience growing up in England. And you joked that to do this film, you had to go to dude school to prepare for the character, to learn both the Western things, but I think also to learn that style of like cowboy. So what are some of the things you had to learn and which was the most interesting for you?
I knew I'd get snapshots or feelings of who Phil was from my encounter, but with people who actually lived that life in Montana and who were graceful enough to let me into their world and educate me and give me an access to that extraordinary experience of working with animals. Extraordinary in the sense that it's often a coordination between four species. There was one moment when we were driving cattle and there were horses, there were men, there was a silence at times but whistled or talked communication between dogs, and those four species working together was just something profoundly affecting. And realizing that and the connection to landscape was really as informative as any of the specifics of braiding, say, or whittling or whistling loudly, say, or the horse riding skills or any of the other kind of attributes this character has at his disposal, and of course the banjo playing, his musicality, but to marry the brutality of being able to master the hard work in that hard landscape and those hard times with this amazing delicacy and sensitivity, I thought that was at the core of his character.
In the novel and in the book, Phil rarely bathes. In the novel, it's specified he bathes once a month in the creek. And when the creek freezes over in the winter, well, then he just won't bathe. So in trying to really get with the character, you stop bathing for extended intervals while making the movie. I assume that was while making the movie. But like, that must have been a really icky experience for you. I mean, once you start to smell yourself and you realize other people are definitely smelling you and not acclimated to the smell like you are, that must have like been very uncomfortable and maybe even a little embarrassing.
In rehearsals, I did it for about a week before my family turned up in New Zealand where we were rehearsing and shooting the film. And I did it because I didn't want that to be something they had to endure. And I thought, you know, this is fine. This is about me getting used to it and Jane and, you know, maybe a couple of other people during the rehearsal period in that time. But then she'd say things like, oh, let's go and get some sushi. And I'd be like, oh, come on. Now I've got to walk out into the real world, not in character, possibly being recognized and carrying this kind of biohazard level heft of stink around with me. That's not fair.
I could see the tweets like Benedict Cumberbatch really smells.
It's enough to be self-conscious of it in any normal circumstance, let alone the heightened one I find myself in as someone recognized. But I think where it's essential and where it really helped was on filming days. I washed a lot more than Phil did, put it that way, but I would not had my clothes laundered. So I did carry his body odor with me. The minute I put those clothes on, I was him. I could smell him And the minute they were off, I was me again. And I would clean myself up when I got home. But for the entire day, that was it. But I don't need to take my work home with me in order to provide authenticity for the moment-to-moment drama of a shoot. And I think it's really true. We wash ourselves a lot. We're very concerned about smelling neutral or pleasant. And this guy just didn't. And he lived in a time where people would smell.
You don't bring the character home with you, but you do keep the character when you're on set. You stay in character even when you're not filming.
I did with this one.
What does that... You don't always do it, but you did with this. What does that do for you? What's the advantage of that?
Well, I think what it does is if you're far away from who you are, it just gives you the ability to have a focus and a hook that's complete. You know, you're narrowing the chance for distraction so that your concentration can be more complete. It's also more a sublimation of the self and than it is method. Method is really pulling on your own psycho trauma and drama to facilitate the same in a character. And this is so far from my lived experience on every single level that, you know, a lot of this had to be manifested for me. Normally, I think my brain, either as a producer, which I'm doing now as well, or just as a curious filmmaker, kind of creeps into other people's business a bit. Not open in a intrusive or negative way, but I because I'm curious, so I'll lean into watching an actor's process, or I'll get interested in choices, or I'll wonder what the camera's doing or how that bit's going to be edited. I couldn't do that with this. I needed my concentration to be absolute. And normally being in character for me during the day, it comes and goes. I can switch it on and off, and that's fine. And the only thing I maintain if it's a accent that's foreign to me would be to stay in the character's voice. For Strange, I stay in his New York American dialect for as much of the day as I'm playing him. But for this, it needed something absolute. I needed to kind of blinker out my reality.
Jane Campion likes to explore different meanings of masculinity, and she certainly does that in this film. As we've talked about, your character seems to be a real bully and prides himself on, you know, this real macho. And the things that he does are very, like, you know, masculine things, like cattle herding, castrating cattle, wearing spurs and stomping around. And what are some of your insights into, to the extent that you can share them with an audience that includes many people who have not seen the film, what are some of your insights about what made him that way? Because when we talk about a certain type of, like, quote, toxic masculinity, it's always interesting to think about what's behind that.
What's really fascinating about bringing a character like Phil Burbank to life, you're really looking under the hood of it. You're examining the causality behind that toxic masculinity. Within that bracket, though, of behavior labeled toxic masculinity, I think there are genuine non-performative elements that he has just grown into being. I do believe that he is that ranch man. I do believe that he is that capable. He's a master of his crafts, whether it's the banjo or whether it's whittling or whether it's, I mean, the stuff that isn't the film, Iron Marguerite, taxidermy. He really is profoundly gifted. I think where it becomes toxic is where he has a need to protect things in a world and hate on a world potentially through that defensive protectiveness before it hates on him. And I mean, to talk about the landscape a bit, for me, that was just an absolute gift. Our production designer, Grant Major, built a really masterful set. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of reality where there was absolutely nothing. And that was integral to filming in New Zealand. There were 360 degrees of nothing, which in Montana, near where the film's actually located, it sadly isn't the case. But logistically, very difficult to film there. But for an actor to be supplanted in that landscape with Grant's set, I mean, everywhere I looked, I had Phil. I had him in the weather. I had him in the sound of the wind and the grass. I had him in the movement and the breath of the cattle, the hair playing on the horse's back, which is actually a detail in the film that Jane picks up on with Ari's cinematography. And I just felt utterly nourished by the placement of where we were shooting it. My big fear was once we got to an a studio in Auckland, I'd be having to clink across a car park in spurs and furry chaps and just feeling ludicrous, like I'm at some kind of Comic-Con convention of Power of the Dog rather than anything as real as the lived experience on that set on location was. And then the pandemic happened and we stopped and our dreams became supercharged as the collective consciousness had this massive shockwave sent across it. And we came back to the work not only with a renewed vigor and focus, but just amplification of gratitude to be able to work.
My guest is Benedict Cumberbatch. He stars in the new film, The Power of the Dog, and plays Doctor Strange in the new film, Spider-Man No Way Home. We'll talk more after a break, and Maureen Carrigan will review one of the most anticipated books of the year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. Let's get back to my interview with Benedict Cumberbatch. He stars in the new film, The Power of the Dog. Cumberbatch was named Best Actor for his performance in the film by the National Society of Film Critics. You can also see Cumberbatch now in Spider-Man No Way Home as Doctor Strange, which is the biggest box office hit since the start of the pandemic. So, you know, at the same time you're in Power of the Dog, you're also in Spider-Man No Way Home, which is a movie in the Marvel Universe, and you played Doctor Strange, and I mean, you have your own Doctor Strange movies, and this is like you're a character in the Spider-Man film. You just finished the latest, or about to finish the latest Doctor Strange film. The Marvel Universe seems so different from, say, the Jane Campion universe. She directed Power of the Dog. For example, like you stayed in character when you did your role of Phil in The Power of the Dog, and you know you kept your accent. Now you could keep your accent when you're doing Doctor Strange because it's a New York accent, not a British accent. But I'm thinking how funny it would be if all of the characters in a Marvel Universe movie, all the superheroes, stayed in character while they're on set. I mean, that would just be kind of ridiculous.
That would make it officially the most exhausting job you could possibly do as an actor.
And damaging too, because you don't really have superpowers.
There's that as well. That, yeah, exactly. That could be pretty devastating to come out of. But imagine that lunch chat. No, it's true. It would be a very bizarre situation because mainly it's such a fragmented piecemeal process making one of those films. I've watched incredible actors use an insane amount of skills on those sets to just be able to magically turn it on, be fresh with it, and be loose with what's one of the biggest sand pits in the world, and play, and never forget the art of acting as playfulness. But that takes a huge amount of ability. And to be able to shift it and create something connected and present when you're acting against so many elements that aren't there, when you're having to use your imagination, it is like being back in the bedroom again and just playing with characters that aren't seen, that we do from in our childhood. I think it's a very, very heightened skill.
You come from a really interesting family. Your parents were both actors in England on stage and screen.
Yes, they're still actors.
Are both actors. Yeah, okay, good. And your family tree includes a great-grandfather who was a diplomat and served as consul in Turkey and Lebanon, and a great-great-grandfather who was a British consul in Turkey and the Russian Empire, and a paternal grandfather who was a submarine officer in both world wars and a prominent figure in London high society. At least that's what I've read. Hopefully that's all true. Did you feel connected to them, and did they feel connected to a larger history? I mean, like my grandparents were immigrants, so I have no roots past them on American soil. But you have these, deep roots in British history. And I don't know, how did that affect your perspective on who you were?
Yeah, I don't. It sounds very callous to say this, but not much, because I don't know enough about my family history. Really, I've never taken a huge interest in it, because for me it's always been about a very close knit circle of individuals. I don't come from a very very big family. I never met either my grandfathers. My grandmothers were of an age when I was young. My parents had me quite late. So my connection to my past, I learn about as much about it, or I'm reminded as much about it, or made aware of it being present as much about it by the description that you just gave. It doesn't inform who I am. I feel that I kind of just started as me. And my parents' influence is the be-all and end-all as far as family goes. And I was an only child. And I think, I don't speak much about my private life, but obviously Sophie's my wife, and she comes from a much larger family, three of them children, two brothers. And that expansive extended family that's now part of my life is a very new experience for me, a wonderful thing as well, beautiful, inspiring and supportive and loving thing. And hello to any of them listening. They're so large, I'm sure one of them is. There's so many of them. But I guess I lived the life of an only child, and you really do think you're the center of the universe. I mean, not in a sort of arrogant way, but just you don't know any different. So I'm only really learning now a little bit more about my family's history.
Your parents were both actors. Did you spend a lot of time backstage watching them when you were growing up?
I did a bit. I mean, I've got a very vivid memory of Mum walking from, one of those very sort of ordinary flats of wood, decorated obviously on the other side for the audience as a room. And I remember her just being my mum, and then a beat of something happening to her, her opening the door and being completely someone else and walking out into the heat and the light. I don't know, it's just a very strong memory. I must have been, around somewhere between the ages of 8 and 12, I'll say, and I was entranced by that moment of shift, that moment of transformation, and what that meant. How could she be my mum one minute and then suddenly be this other person for people watching her?
What made you want to act?
I think moments like that, pretty much from, I would say, 12 or so onwards. I mean, my parents, being actors, didn't want me to be a child actor. They wanted me to have a childhood free of being in the public eye, to have a natural, for want of a better term, development that's not exposed, I guess, that young. And they wanted me to have an education. They were very keen for me not to be an actor. They were very keen for me to be anything but an actor. And that's why they were working so hard to give me the opportunity to be a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher or whatever it might be, or someone in the diplomatic. I don't know what their ambitions for me were really, but I don't think they wanted me to be an actor. And then there was this one moment of blessing, which I think was the other real kind of gear change, and thinking, okay, right, I'm going to be able to do this as a living now that I've got my father's blessing. And I've been talking about it a lot recently, but it still remains a profoundly moving and humble thing to recount. My dad, basically, after playing Salieri in Amadeus, took me by the shoulders. This is at university, so I must have been around 20, and said, "You're better at this than I ever was or ever will be, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do with it as a career." And for a father to say that to his child, just enormous.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Benedict Cumberbatch stars in the new film, The Power of the Dog. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of one of this year's most anticipated books, the novel To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara. Her 2015 novel, A Little Life, dealt with the challenges of disability and trauma and became a bestseller. Here's Maureen's review of To Paradise.
Beyond everything else, it is Hanya Yanagihara's new novel, To Paradise, is a deliberately difficult novel. It weighs in at just over 700 pages and breaks into three distinct books, which read like semi-autonomous novels in their own right. Each book is set in New York City a century apart and invokes an array of literary styles, from the novel of manners to alternate history, from the old-fashioned epistolary novel to the explicit social commentary of speculative fiction. Repetition is Yanagihara's organizing principle here. The same names and situations resurface every 100 years, and other random coincidences abound. Perhaps that's why, when reading To Paradise, I couldn't help but think of the coincidence that it's being published in the centenary year of another deliberately difficult novel, James Joyce's Ulysses. Ulysses also weighs in at just over 700 pages and is also packed with repetitions, scenes where characters unknowingly repeat incidents from the Odyssey. There, the comparisons end. But my own take on To Paradise does mirror the reactions of Ulysses' first overwhelmed readers. When Ulysses came out in 1922, it was hailed by a few critics as brilliant, but dismissed by others as baffling and dull. Virginia Woolf confessed she had to force herself to push past the first 200 pages. I have all those responses to Yanagihara's novel. It's inspired and vivid, but there are also long stretches that are so flat and opaque that only a looming deadline made me press forward. Book one of To Paradise is the most reader-friendly and contains some of the novel's most gorgeous language. It's set in 1893 in a New York that belongs to an independent nation called the Free States. The Free States have legalized gay marriage and given full rights to women, but keep out Black and Indigenous people. The way communities and nations, even allegedly progressive ones, define themselves by whom they exclude is a theme Yanagihara touches on frequently. Events here take place largely within a townhouse in Washington Square. That's Henry James territory, and sure enough, this section riffs on James's novel called Washington Square, the story of a charming cad seeking to marry a shy, plain heiress. The lovelong heiress of this tale is reimagined as an heir, a young gay man named David Bingham, whose sickliness and awkwardness have made him damaged goods on the marriage market. As David reflects, he was a man living in his grandfather's house, waiting for one season to shade into the next, for his life to announce itself to him at last. What ensues is a melancholy story about seduction, willed self-delusion, and the cruelty the world inflicts on the vulnerable. The second book of To Paradise takes place 100 years later, in 1993, partly in that same townhouse in Greenwich Village. The David of this story is a cash-strapped young Hawaiian man living with a debonair older lover named Charles. The AIDS epidemic imbues this section with a twilight mood, but unfortunately, book two drifts into a dense ending monologue narrated by David's father, who belongs to the Hawaiian royal family. The final and longest book of To Paradise drags us deep into dystopia. New York in 2093 has been ravaged by climate change and mutating deadly viruses. That Washington Square townhouse is now chopped into apartments. Among the characters we meet here are two reincarnations of the Charles character. A Charles who's a renowned virologist, and his granddaughter, Charlie, who's emotionally and physically compromised. It's her grandfather's effort to save her from the ruthlessness of an authoritarian government that propels this narrative after a sluggish start. The greatest pleasures of To Paradise are technical ones. The seemingly effortless variety of Yanagihara's writing styles, the changes she rings on a fixed group of characters and situations. But unlike other sprawling books that are also explicitly contrived, yes, Ulysses, or Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and most recently Anthony Doerr's Cloud Cuckoo Land, To Paradise sacrifices emotional depth to artistic design. With the exception of the fully realized David in book one, characters seem summoned up simply to serve the novel's pattern. And that pattern of eternal return makes this big novel feel confined. Sometimes a complicated puzzle contains dazzling individual pieces that lose their luster when pressed together.
Maureen Corrigan is a professor of literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara. Coming up, we hear from Brian Cox. He plays Logan Roy, the ruthless patriarch in the HBO series Succession. He has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest, Brian Cox, is one of the stars of the HBO series Succession, a social, political, family satire embedded in a drama. Cox plays Logan Roy, the patriarch in a family-owned business empire, Waystar Royco, that becomes publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It includes a conservative cable news network, cruise lines, theme parks, and more. His daughter and sons are competing over who will succeed their aging father when he's ready to step down or dies. Logan is all about power plays that will lead to more power and more money with little regard for ethics, morality, or the consequences of his actions on the lives of others. When Logan's son Kendall asked Logan if he ever thought that Kendall could take over, here's how Logan responded.
You're not a killer. You have to be a killer.
That wasn't a fair assessment, because Kendall went on to prove he did have killer instincts as he tried to take down his father. Ruthlessness is a trait that Logan succeeded in passing on to his children. Cox won a Golden Globe for his performance in Succession and is now nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award. He's written a new memoir called Putting the Rabbit in the Hat. It begins in Dundee, Scotland, where he grew up after nearly dying at birth. Let's hear another clip from Succession. In this scene, Waystar Royco is being investigated by the Justice Department, and Logan's daughter Shiv is worried because she knows about the whistleblowers and the intimidation of victims. Shiv is played by Sarah Snook.
Can we talk?
Yes, we can talk.
Okay, well, we're a big company, but how bad is what is the worst thing?
Not
to
all
be in
that
those papers?
Bad. Health, safety, compliance, a few bad apples. What?
Well, I know that isn't true. Come on, Dad. Tom worked in cruises. Bill told him everything. And besides, I know that there were black ops, and I know that there was targeted intimidation of victims and whistleblowers. The NRPI, say.
Maybe there were some salty moves.
You can't just change your story.
I want to keep you clean. I put Jerry in, but I can't trust her. She's optics. I need you. Listen. I didn't know about any of this.
Well, you're on emails.
Do you know how many emails I get a day? I don't read my emails. I get the action points.
I know.
Shiv, the world is rough. We ran a cruise line out of some tin pot ports registered in Bongo Hovels, and we poured millions in it. Sure, did we play rough with the odd union boss or some moaning mini repeat litigant? I don't know. It was a quarter of a century ago. A lot of it. So, yes, I fought for you and your brothers. But you will not find a piece of paper that makes you ashamed of me. Okay?
Well, the government does have an unbelievable amount of leverage at its disposal, Dad. The law?
Yeah, the law. The law is people. And people is politics. And I can handle a people.
Brian Cox, welcome to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to have you back on the show. I love Succession and I love you in it. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Good to be back. Good to be back, Terry.
The last line in the scene that we just played is so good. The law is people and people is politics and I can handle the people. That's such a memorable line. Like, that's going to be a quoted line. So when you saw that line, did you think like, wow, this is a good one?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's so many good lines in the show. And, you know, it's very, he's a very interesting, you know, he's an extraordinary character, Logan. I mean, he's probably one of the most extraordinary characters I've ever played because he is not what he appears to be. This is the interesting thing about Logan. I mean, he seems to be like this demon, And of course, he is a misanthrope. You know, he is very disappointed with the human experiment. He and I both share that, except he's a pessimist and I'm an optimist. So that's the big difference between both of us. So at the same time, he's got a history, but he's also, you know, he's not. He just tells it like it is, and he's a truth teller, and it's not pleasant, and people don't like it, and they always suspect his motives, but his motives are always to do with the business, it's always to do with the firm, it's always to do with what he's created. That's his concern. But Roman then does, he said, well, what are you doing it for? And he says, well, maybe love. And of course, this is like a red rag to a bull, because there isn't a lot of love coming from his children. You know, they talk about love, but, you know, he loves them, but where's the reciprocal? I mean, they just see him as a cash cow, you know, so much of the time. And that's the dilemma of the part, you know, is the fact that he's constantly caught on this dilemma of loving his children, but finding them constantly wanting as individuals.
Okay. I have to stop you here and say, I love that you are totally describing this from the point of view of your character, Logan Roy. What yes, you are leaving out here is the fact that he has no morals, he has no ethics, and if his children are spoiled and come up short on things, it's because that's how he brought them up. It seems like he brought them up, manipulating them, teaching them to fight for power, to fight with each other among, you know, for power. He's totally manipulative of them. He shows them no love. So, but you're really seeing it from his point of view.
I don't think he's capable of expressing love in that way. I think that's his problem.
That is a problem.
That's his difficulty.
You
know,
a big problem.
He's not, he can't do it because, just again, because of his background, you know, the historical inevitability of your own relationship, what you come through, who you become out of what you become or what you are, is always the kind of crux of any individual. You know, we are the sum of our history, and Logan is the sum of his history, which is a mysterious history and is a thwarted history. And I mean, I don't defend Logan in any way. But I also, you know, one of the jobs as an actor is we cannot judge our characters. But at the same time, we have to have a kind of eye on where our characters are. We've got to see them for, you know, in terms of the narrative of the show, in terms of what is required at any given moment.
You asked the writers, does Logan love his children? Why did you need to ask? And how did the answer affect your performance?
I needed to know because because is he just cruel? You know, is he needlessly cruel? Because I thought, if he's needlessly cruel, this is going to be a very boring show for me. You know, I'm going to be playing one line throughout. And Jesse said, no, he loves his kids. So that's always the tension in his life, is that he actually loves his children. But constantly, and partly his responsibility, because of the way he's brought them up. But, you know, there comes a point. I mean, I remember the great actor Brian Dennehy saying this to me, and I always remembered it. He said, you know, after a certain age, all bets are off. You can blame your parents for everything, but finally there's a point where you've got to say, hang on, you know. You know, I'm 30 now. I can't just keep blaming my mum and dad for my conditioning. You know, there's a point where I have to use my own intelligence and say, hang on, let me get the perspective on this. And of course, this is what human beings sometimes, a lot of the time, fail to do.
I want to ask you about your birth. You were born after your mother had 4 or 5 miscarriages, and you nearly died in childbirth. Can you explain the complications of your birth?
Yeah, it was a horrendous thing for my poor ma. I mean, she was the one that really suffered because when I came into the world, I brought half a womb with me as well at the same time. Yeah, I mean, it was a struggle for her, and she was quite ill. She'd had several miscarriages before me, and she was 40, I think, when I was born. Yeah, she was 40. Or she was coming up to 40. It was horrendous. It was a horrendous birth. And, of course, you know, the whole thing about that sort of working class thing is you just put up with it. You know, there was no complaints. I remember that, you know, my first wife, you know, we lost children, we lost twins. And my mother came to stay, and my mother had this expression, which is, I'll have to do it in a Scottish accent because that's, so when I was saying, you know, Caroline, my wife, I said, I'm worried about Ma. She said, you know, because the twins and losing the twins. And she said, Bren, we've had drop bairns, which is an extraordinary thing to say, which was, we've all dropped babies. So this was like a common thing among, you know, the women, you know, miscarriage wasn't something that was, you know, unusual. It was a process that women horrifically went through. You know, I mean, horrifically. And my mum was part of that, you know.
So when you were born, among the complications was that the umbilical cord was wrapped around your throat. Your legs were in the wrong position.
I came in arse first.
Yeah, and as you say, your mother was physically and emotionally scarred by the birth.
Terrible.
Did she talk with you about, like, how old were you when you found out how difficult the birth was and the impact it had physically and emotionally on your mother?
I kind of got it when I was really quite young. I mean, I think my mom told me eventually after she was, you know, she'd been ill and she came home briefly, but she was never the same. You know, she had electric shock treatment, so a lot of her memory stuff had gone, short-term memory had gone, long-term memory was fine. So she did tell me about the birth, you know, and I was kind of, you know, it was a miracle, you know, because I did have the cord wrapped around my neck and I did come, I don't know what I must have thought. I mean, what I felt was, and I was the other way around as well, that's why I came, because obviously I was heading towards the birth canal and I thought, there's no way I can get through here, so I had to turn around, you know, and went the other way, you know, which was... it's a weird, weird thing.
Your father, when he died, you were 8 years old. No one had told you that he'd been diagnosed 3 weeks before with pancreatic cancer, so you were shocked. And so you lost a father, you lost his love, you lost his income, you lost the security of having a family that was, I mean, you were poor after he died. So how poor were you?
Oh, well, yeah, we were really poor. Well, the I suppose the worst example, it didn't happen all the time, but the example of it would be, we get to a Thursday night, and my mother got a pension on the Friday, and we wouldn't have any food. So I would go across to the fish and chip shop across the road from us, and I would, he was great, Mario, you know, he Carino, and he would say, and I would go in and I'd say, listen, can I have some batter bits? Now, batter bits are the bits that lie at the back of the pan. And he would give me a bag of batter bits, and that would be our dinner. It didn't happen all the time, but it did happen at least, I think, 3 times.
So your period of becoming an actor coincided with this new period of social mobility where working class actors...
The greatest time.
Were becoming accepted and working class stories started being told in movies in England. Did you feel like your accent or your background ever held you back, either in your training at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art or in your access to roles?
I mean, it did in a way. I mean, it's a feudal society. And it's everybody in their place. And the great thing about the 60s is that anything was possible. You were encouraged to be who you were. You were encouraged to be able to talk in your own accent. And all of that started to change. Though, ironically, the Scottish thing didn't kick in till later. So actually, I ended up playing, when I started out, playing a lot of Liverpool people or Yorkshire. I did David Story plays, so I played a lot of Yorkshire people. You know, I did a film and then I did a couple of plays in that way. So that was the sense of social mobility. And the other great influence, of course, at the time was what was happening in music, because it was the time of the Beatles, it was the time of the Rolling Stones, it was the time of the Who, the Kinks. So the music thing had burgeoned, and those guys, I mean, when I watched that wonderful documentary with Paul McCartney, that thing from Get Back from those days when they recorded the last album. It was like, it moved me to tears because that was the energy that was so in the atmosphere that anything was possible, that we could do it. And it subsequently dissipated horribly because of everybody saying, oh, just remember who you are, you know, and it's still as futile as it ever was. And the people won't even see it because it's kind of hidden. It's in the fabric of the society.
So one more question, because I know you have to go. You write about how your father was a confirmed agnostic, your mother was a fervent Catholic, although she came to question that when her mental health started to fail. You write that you think when we die, it's like turning off an appliance. It's just the switch is off, and it's as simple as that. How did you come up with that appliance analogy? And does it give you comfort to think that, to think like you die and that's it?
Well, I think so. You know, we have so many, you know, we have the whole God stuff, you know, and our whole, everything, our lives are all predicated on this idea of there's life after death, that it's this and that's the next thing. And I go, no, I mean, I just think it's energy, and when it's switched off, it's switched off. And when you go, you know. You know, and there's all kinds of things. I mean, there's a very interesting thing that happened to my wife. My father-in-law passed quite recently. And this, I mean, I do think we're part of some kind of process. So I do think there's something going on other than the God thing. There is something going on with the whole business of life, that we are part of a big, huge experiment that's going on. And it was interesting, my wife, who's much more spiritual than I am, she said to her dad, you know, just before he died, he said, you know, send me a sign. And what happened was that when he died, they kept his body, and it was very because he was Iranian, her father. My wife is half Iranian. And normally they bury the bodies very quickly, but no, they kept the body for a couple of days, and people came and saw him, and he was in bed, dead. And on the last day, it was getting a bit smelly, so she opened the windows, and this robin flew in. And it flew around the room, and it sat. There was a photograph of our maternal grandparents who were both passed, and the robin sat there for a bit. And then it got up, and it flew, and it landed right on my late father-in-law's head and sat there for several minutes. And then it took off, circled, and then it flew off and flew out. So you go, this is astonishing. And my wife's got the photograph of her father with the bird sitting on his head. And it's, so you go, there's something, but I don't know what it is.
Brian Cox, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much. And thank you for your portrayal of Logan Roy. I love the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's always good to talk to you. Challenging, but great in a good way.
Brian Cox is a star of the HBO series Succession. His new memoir is called Putting the Rabbit in the Hat. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salat, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.